Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us today as we focus a bit on birds and plants. We have lost 3 billion birds in the past 50 years, and 70 species have lost half or more of their breeding population. But as gardeners, you and I can help turn this around, and we have a guest that can help us in that process. Mariette Nowak is the author of the book Birdscaping for Wisconsin and the Great Lakes Region. Have it in front of me. She's an active leader and volunteer for Wild Ones, Native Plants, and Natural Landscapes. She's also a public speaker on landscaping, native plants, and birding, and is the former director of the Weir Nature Center. It's a unit of the Milwaukee County Parks in Wisconsin. So as we talk with Mariette, I hope you'll join in. Have you noticed that maybe different birds are attracted to different plants in your yard? What would you like to know about creating a bird-friendly yard? Join in. Give us a call. Number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org. And certainly we would love to hear from you. Mariette Nowak, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here. Nice to talk to you today.
I've enjoyed your book very much, and we'll be zeroing in on it today. But just spend a minute or two on birds here, just to begin. We're losing a lot of birds, and in your mind, why? What are the main causes?
Well, loss of habitat, and that's where we can come in with planting plants. But there's other, threats too. Pesticides and climate change and things like that. So, yeah, we have an invasive weeds. And so there's a lot of different threats. And even in our own homes, there's threats from windows that birds don't see. They see the reflection and think they can fly right through. And there's cats that are one of our invasive species. And we should keep those indoors because cats kill a lot of birds. Millions of birds every year in our country. And so those are some of the threats to birds.
And there are tipping point species right now, aren't they? And maybe talk about tipping point.
Oh, you mean the species that are declining? Well, even some of our common birds are declining a lot. I really haven't checked exactly which species. I'd have to go into that. But we know how to help these birds. So I think if we really zero in on the birds that are declining, we can help. We can help by landscaping, but also things like the Endangered Species Act that has helped so much to restore some of our really endangered birds. And for example, the trumpeter swan was very low numbers previously, as well as the crane,
sandhill cranes. Yeah.
Those were helped immensely by our efforts to provide habitat for them. And but we can, for the smaller birds, we can do the same right in our own backyards.
And that's what you've done in your book. Somebody says, does the bird feeder help? Well, does it or doesn't it?
Oh, I have bird feeders, too. I kind of reduce them a little bit in the summer. But I do feel that's a great way to see the birds and to supplement them when things are not available for them in your own yard or whatever. So especially in winter, it's great for birds and can really be helpful in sustaining their populations.
Explain what you've got in your book here. It's the title, of course, is Birdscaping for Wisconsin and the Great Lakes Region, and the subtitle, The 50 Best Native Plants to Attract Birds to Your Midwest Garden. And it's full of great information, but explain how you've got it organized.
Okay, I have it organized. Not just, some books just list all the good plants for birds, but what I like always to do is to consider their habitats and the groups of birds that need particular kinds of habitats. So in my book, I have highlighted five different groups of birds and the best plants for those birds. The hummingbirds, of course, we only have one species, but that's such a beloved species. I have a whole chapter on that. And then there are goldfinches and other prairie birds that like open areas, meadows, prairies, and so forth, and we can make pocket prairies right in our backyards. And then there are birds like bluebirds and cedar waxwings that are more like savanna birds, which are birds that like a kind of an open area, but there's always a few trees, and that's what a savanna is. And then there are birds that just love shrubs, and they eat and nest and live almost their entire lives right in shrubs. And there are woodland birds, too. And there's a variety of our trees, and there's different kinds of birds that prefer different trees oftentimes, although some trees, you know, furnish all the needs for a variety of birds.
You know, I like, and you go through the 50 plants, but one thing I like about your book a lot is, for each plant, there is the plant itself, so a little description of the plant. Then it's the value of the plant to birds and other wildlife, and then how to grow that particular plant. And then, propagation of the plant, and then companion plants. And then you've got something called a closer look, which I like a lot because it's just some little side information relating to the plant and the insects that might be attracted to it or the birds that might be attracted to it. And, you have a little bit of information there just to take a little closer look at it. And I love that approach.
Oh, thank you. I liked it, too. It was fun to consider all the different unique things about the plants, for example.
Oh, we suddenly lost Mariette. No Nowak. But you know what? We'll get her right back. Mariette Nowak is the author of Birdscaping for Wisconsin and the Great Lakes region. While we're getting her back, I tell you what, I'll let you know what's on next week for Garden Talk. Next week, we're going to be talking with the author of Gardening Can Be Murder, which is kind of a cool book. And then we'll take a look at caring for succulents. So that's next week on the program, and we'll take a short break. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk here on WPR News. Great to have you along today. And we lost Mariette Nowak, but we've got her back. Mariette, again, the author of Birdscaping for Wisconsin and the Great Lakes region. Great to have her back. Mariette, we lost you, but you're back. It's good to have you back.
I'm glad I'm back, too. I apologize for that. I thought I stopped call waiting, but I have a call waiting. So I'm back, though.
Okay. What were your – maybe just talk for a minute about your research sources. You have a rich selection or a rich number of resources that you used.
Yes. Okay. Well, I've used a variety of research, partly my own, my own observations and information, and also a lot of information from Doug Tallamy, a professor who has been very prominent in highlighting the need for insects for our birds. So I have a lot on insects. I think we need to love our insects, and then I also the plants themselves. There's some online resources in regard to the documenting of the plants themselves.
So you got a lot there. You have a lot there for sure. You know, and the focus is a lot on native plants here. Why are native plants the best for birdscaping?
Well, native plants have been around with birds for millions of years, and they've developed a special interrelationship. Plants have often, sometimes even evolved in a way to accommodate the birds because the birds then help disperse those plants. And also, the birds have sometimes adapted to special plants. For example, hummingbirds often have beaks that are just the right size for the plants they prefer. A ruby-crowned hummingbird here in our eastern North America, for example, has a beak just right for some of the flowers that it prefers. So that's kind of an exciting thing to look into. And so that's why native plants are best. They've given nourishment and cover to birds for millions of years, and our native plants do really are better sources of that than our invasive or even our cultivated plants. In a way, our cultivated, for example, insects cannot feed on many of the invasive or non-native plants. And so our birds, 97% of which need insects to feed their young, they do not do well if there's just cultivated plants, for example. In fact, we don't realize that by planting ornamental plants, we're really starving our birds because there's no insects for the birds. And as I said, most nestlings need insects for protein.
Yeah, I remember a reference you had to a study of chickadees. I think it took place in D.C.
Right.
Talk about that for a second.
Sure. These were urban and suburban homes in Washington, D.C., quite a number of them. I can't remember the exact number of homes. But they studied the nesting of chickadees in these properties. And the properties that had mostly cultivated and non-native plants, the chickadees actually either didn't nest, or if they did nest, their young didn't survive because they didn't have enough insects. They just didn't do well. And what was found out is that you need at least 70% of native plants in order to help chickadees survive. And we surmise that's true for most birds, that you need a lot of native plants that can provide the all the nourishment that they've evolved with, you know, that they've prospered with through the millions of years.
Yeah. Mariette Nowak, our guest, as we talk birdscaping for Wisconsin, we're going to get into the plants that she features. She features 50 plants in her book and talk about growing them and successfully and which birds and insects are attracted to these specific plants. And you can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on nativars? Are probably we shouldn't be planting all nativars.
That's right. Nativars are the cultivated versions of native plants. They've done something different for those plants that make them less oftentimes, not all the time, but oftentimes less good for birds. Sometimes they don't even form seeds, for example, or the colors are different and that changes the chemistry, so the insects that birds need cannot feed on them. So generally, cultivars are not recommended at all. I mean, there's some that might be good, but we can never study all of those and, you know, all the, hundreds of plants. We can't study. There's not enough. There's not enough people to do all that research. The best thing is just to stick with natives that have been around all this time and nourish birds, as I said, through the millions of years.
Phil in Mount Horeb has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Phil.
Hi. I have been running a bluebird string for over 30 years, and I was in Connecticut when I took a course, a short course from Dr. David Hill, who is affiliated with Yale, and he was a bluebird enthusiast, and he said, and I think that this is important for all people who want to site bluebird boxes, that you should have some kind of perch within 30 feet of the front of the box so that the fledglings, who have never flown before and are heavy and plump compared to their wing size, could make it out without falling into the grass and then never getting out, of course. I have preached this to many people over the years, including to members of a prominent bluebird organization here in Wisconsin, and I have gotten a lukewarm response, and it confuses me because the logic about a heavy little never-flown bird trying to make it out in life, it's difficult enough for all of us to do that, but especially for a little bird like that. So I wanted to get your guest a comment on that, if that's a current thought stream in the birding and bluebird community, and how we can encourage more people to sight either a tee or to sight a tee to allow the birds to fly to a perch, or to sight the box near a shrub or tree that they can alight on.
Hi, yeah, I absolutely agree with that. In my first book, I believe I even addressed that because, yes, you're right. And in my own yard, I do have a bluebird box that is, you know, like you said, about, I don't know how many yards, I'm not good at measurements, but yes, they can fly to that tree and perch as when they're nestlings. That's absolutely correct, and I'm glad that you're educating everyone about that.
Phil, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too, at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Well, it sort of brings up the whole business of the kinds of features we should be providing, plant features that we should be providing for birds to come to our garden.
Yes, definitely. Of course, you know, with hummingbirds, you want to plant plants that have the shape and so forth that invite hummingbirds. And sometimes those same plants will kind of deter insects competition for those plants. So, yeah, I have in my book a number of the features of a hummingbird plant. They're tubular. They often don't have a landing pad because the insects need that, where hummingbirds are great for hovering and so forth. So yes, that's important. And then, you know, it's a prairie plant. A lot of the composites, the open sunflower-like plants are great for those birds because they provide insects and sometimes even nectar for the birds. So yeah, and then seeds, that's even more important in the later in the summer and so forth. A lot of those goldfinches and other finches and prairie birds need a lot of seeds. So the prairie plants that I highlight specialize in that. And so far, and then some birds like birds and others like a lot of fruit too. I mean, although they eat insects, bluebirds also need a lot of berries as well as insects. So, yeah, so it definitely you have to have the right plants for the right birds is really important if you want to have certain species or if you want to have a variety. I mean, a lot of people might have a little shrubby corner and a little open pocket prairies, so forth, in their own backyard. So, yeah, you can have a variety like that, and then you'll have more variety in the birds that you attract and nourish.
Yeah. Seeds or plants? Do you use both a combination of seeds and plants when you're putting something like this together?
Well, plants that provide seeds, yes. In each case, what I'm trying to do in each of those five groups of birds, I'm trying to furnish all the different nourishment needs that they might have. For example, some birds for example, shrubland birds like a lot of berries, but they also need they also need insects and so forth. And so we try to, I'm trying in each case to provide all the kinds of food that particular group of birds, whether they're prairie birds or shrubland birds or woodland birds, all the kinds that they might need throughout their life cycle.
Let's take a look and zero in a bit on some of the plants and kind of by area maybe. And you started with the ruby throated hummingbirds, and you list 10 plants that you like for them. One of them is wild columbine.
Right. That's our first main native plant that provides nectar for the hummingbirds. And oftentimes, ornithologists have watched and observed that they follow the blossoming of the columbine as they go north. So that's a great one for the beginning of the year. And then I have jewelweed blossoms later in the year, and that sort of frames the year because the hummingbirds often feed on that as the last plant to blossom in our area, and they follow that as they go south in the fall of the year. And then all the others that I have there provide throughout the season different times that they'll provide nectar for the hummingbirds.
What about, let's take wild columbine for a minute, any particular problems with growing it, or is it sun, shade? What do you think?
Okay, that's a wonderful plant to grow, and sometimes it wants to jump around. I know in my yard I planted it several places, and then it goes up in other parts of the yard. So that's it's kind of like, I think it definitely doesn't like a lot of competition. And partial shade to shade. It grows well in that. It's not too fussy about the soil. It likes dry to moist soil. So you'll find it in the woodland areas and kind of semi-open areas. So it's a great plant to grow, and it's very common through many states. And as far as that goes, it's really a great overall plant for the hummingbirds, and it has a great shape. The tubes or spurs of this columbine actually evolved to the perfect length for the bill of the ruby-throated hummingbird. And spurs contain the nectar. Sometimes if you look closely,
you can see the nectar itself, I'm guessing here. Oh, my gosh. We had a little problem again with our guest, Marianne Nowak, our guest today, and we've lost her again. So we'll get her back, and in the meantime, I'll let you know a couple of other things that are coming up on the show. Just take a look at Monday. We're going to take a look at some health-related things on Monday. We've got an increase in alcohol-related liver disease. We'll be talking about that. We're going to be talking about a new UW-Madison certificate program on aging. We'll get into that as well. And then on Monday, we'll wrap up the show with the Weather Guys. The Weather Guys will be with us for the entire show. And we're going to take another quick break. We'll be back. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today on Garden Talk. For WPR News, Larry Mueller here. We're talking about the book Birdscaping for Wisconsin and the Great Lakes Region with our guest, Mariette Nowak. It's great to have her with us. She's the author of the book, and it contains the 50 best native plants to attract birds to your Midwestern garden. So great to have her with us. Mariette, are you back? Are you with us again?
I apologize for that. Yeah,
oh, okay.
You.
Well, we have Gianni in Montello is with us and has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Gianni.
Yeah. Thanks for taking my call, Larry. Yeah, we put in a hummingbird feeder out. I picked one up at the local Dollar General. It's plastic, and this is the first year that I've used a plastic hummingbird feeder, and ratio of 4-1, four parts water, one part sugar, and they didn't go into it, and I'm wondering why. And my second question is, when should we remove the hummingbird syrup or the feeder in September? Because, you know, we want to encourage the birds to go south. They don't want to get caught here in an ice storm in October. So if you could address those two questions.
Sure. thanks for asking. I have a plastic feeder, and I have never had any problem. Sometimes if the birds in the beginning don't come, you might want to try a stronger solution, a more sugary solution. So I would suggest adding a little sugar. And I don't know if you have it in the same place as your last one. I'm hoping that the hummingbirds are doing well. It could be that they just aren't coming this year. I mean, some people do have a little trouble getting hummingbirds to come, especially if you're in an urban area or even sometimes a suburban area. When I lived in the Milwaukee area, I only got hummingbirds during migration, not during the summer. Now, in regard to your other question, what was that again?
It had to do with feeding in the fall.
Right. In the fall of the year, it is now believed that you should keep up those feeders as long as you want because the hummingbirds will leave when they're ready. And oftentimes, sometimes when you have those feeders up longer, you might get a few stray western species like the rufous. Rufous hummingbird sometimes comes to our area even late in the season. So as I said, just keep it up as long as you want, but just make sure you clean it regularly. That's one of the most important things about hummingbird feeders in the summer. You should be cleaning that every 3 days. So that might be another thing to look at. I remember going to a friend's house, and it was all those little porks were moldy. So you really want to make sure you clean that every 3 days during the summer.
All right. Gianni, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in to 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Ray in Cable emailed to ask what to do in her, she's got a shady northwest Wisconsin yard, Cable, that's way up there. Mostly maple and oak and some pine, and she lives on lakeshore property. And what could she do to add bird magnets to her yard through plants?
Okay, well, trees are plants, so those are great trees to have. And in my book, I just discussed some of the plants that you could add under trees oftentimes. And I'd have to check on that. But for oaks, there's a lot of variety of plants that you could add under oaks. And I really have to check on exactly what would be the best. There's such a variety, it's hard to even zero in on that. But there's, in the northern area, you might have... I'm trying to think of some of those really new, even orchids. You have more orchids up there. And I'm down in southern Wisconsin, so I don't have all those plants on my fingertips, but there's many great plants, almost everything that's there. And then as far as pines, sometimes pines are a little too shady, so you might not have as much variety under there. And but there are some that plants. And what was the third tree you said? Pines and maples.
Oak and some pine. Yeah.
Well, maple would be. Maples can be hard to plant under because they're so shady, especially the sugar maple. And so in that case, just make sure you have lots of leaf litter. The birds love leaf litter. They need a soft landing. And it's been found that almost 94% of the caterpillars that are tree caterpillars fall down after they've been eating the leaves during the summer, and then they find refuge and sustenance down in the leaves. That's where they'll stay for the late fall and winter. So that's a good way to make sure you have the caterpillars that birds need. And I'm afraid that I'm not quite up to date on some of those best plants for way up north like that. But there's a great number of plants that you can find in various sources. The sugar maple certainly has a wonderful color, so you should be very thrilled up there. And I'm hoping that they do well there because they talk about with climate change, we're going to be losing them down here in the southern Wisconsin. So enjoy them and some of the other plants might be, like blueberries are great for birds, that you might grow better up there because the soil is acidic. So that's one of the ones I would suggest. And so let me look at my list here as far as this. I'll have to check on that, but I think a lot of the grasses, too, there's the grasses that love that grow well in woodlands, and some of those might be bottlebrush grass is a good one, and some of the others would be, let's see, I'm trying to think of some other grasses. Oh, like the tan sedge, some of the sedges do well in woodlands. So you have some grasses as well as wildflowers, but I think of any of the northern ones right now other than those.
Let's take a call from Shirley in Marengo next. Hi, Shirley.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. It's regarding the hummingbirds. Around, I think it was year 2021, we had an excessive amount of hummingbirds. We were going through 5 feeders, sometimes twice a day. And Great Gardening from Duluth came in, filmed the gardens and the hummingbirds, and ever since then, it's been declining every year. Now we only have a couple, and I have a lot of gardens, and I was just wondering if there's a decline in hummingbirds or if they just don't always return to the same place, or...
Yeah.
Well, hummingbirds usually come to the same place, but of course, they don't live forever, so maybe the hummingbirds that came previously have passed away, and of course, that addresses the fact that we've lost 3 billion birds over the last 50 years. So that's just a sign of that again. And as far as hummingbirds, think of all the migration that they have across the southern United States, where there have been so many terrible storms and so forth. And I believe climate change is a big factor in the reduced number of birds within the last few years, particularly, and talked about the hummingbirds, and that's very sad to hear about that. So hope it changes and keep up the good work then. Hopefully they'll, I have, by the way, people here have not noticed that so much, so I don't know if it's something up where you live or if they just don't get that far in their migration. I'm sorry to hear that, though, and let's hope it changes as we all work hard to address climate change on our local levels by planting native, and also hopefully soon it'll get better on the national scene.
Yeah, Shirley, thanks for calling. I was thinking back to the plants that you were recommending, and the time of the planting blooming of the plants blooming, and you did talk about wild columbine because they are early flowering. And you talked about the setting and where it fits best in a landscape. But you also mentioned orange jewelweed. Orange jewelweed is a later blooming plant and one of the latest blooming plants. And it may be useful to have both plants in the same yard. Would you plant orange jewelweed near the wild columbine, or would orange jewelweed require more light?
Orange jewelweed generally grows in lighter areas too. But they do like a little more moist soil. So I have them both in my yard. I have both species in my yard, but the one is near a little the orange jewelweed is more in the damp areas. I have a little kettle, and they surround the kettle like a ring of flowers, which is quite lovely. But the jewelweed grows on drier soil near my home, near the house. So, yes, you can grow both, but you might need a slightly different soil or, moisture. And another thing you could do, if you have a little bird bath and it drips over the edge, you could plant some of the plants that you couldn't plant under that, or a sump pump. I've often in my past home, I had a sump pump where it really the soil got very moist in there, and I grew plants there that I couldn't grow in the rest of the yard because it was more moist. So use the water that falls on your property if you have damp spots or if you have a sump pump or a little bird bath that drips over. Those are great places to plant those species that need a little bit more moisture.
And another one of the plants you mentioned, which intrigued me a bit, was pussy willow for attracting ruby-throated hummingbirds. And I'm wondering, what does the pussy willow plant, when, because that's a plant that's pretty easy to grow, I think.
It is, but it does need a little bit of moist soil, too. That can't be a real dry area, but yes, that is pretty easy to grow, and it's really wonderful in many ways. But for the hummingbirds, it also has very small insects early on that are good for the hummingbirds, and then the little fluff can be used when they're nesting. They use that in their nest material. So, but willow is great for many other insects, too, that birds depend on.
So it's not the nectar, it's the insects that they attract that make pussy willow attractive. That's interesting. Blazing Star. Yeah. You mentioned Blazing Star, too, as one of the 10 for hummingbirds. And talk a bit about Blazing Star or gray feather, or gay feather,
oh, yeah.
I should say.
Oh, yeah, it's a wonderful plant. And it's one of our most beautiful plants for either for the hummingbird, but as well as for prairies. And people just love it. And there's about 5 different species that I highlight, and different species can do better in different areas. Some like it a little more damp soil, some do well in very dry soil. And it has a good, the tubes for the birds and so forth. And not only that, but one of them, I was thinking of something else that's like, it also has a very fascinating mechanism in its plants in that the flowers have 2 different stages, the male stage and the female stage. And of course, oftentimes plants have that situation and that prevents self-pollination. So the part of the flower that's the male flower part will ripen first, oftentimes in Blazing Star, they're purple-colored anthers when the male stage is ripe. And when the female is ripe, those anthers turn a tan color. Just sometimes the insects can pick up on that, and they'll know when there is nectar in the plants or when the pollen is best. So that's kind of a fascinating thing also.
Yeah.
So anyway, the interesting things about these plants, and that's what I try to highlight, too, when I discuss them.
Yeah, I think the plants that you have in that list of top 10 for ruby-throated hummingbirds is, in my mind, a great plant list because every one of those plants will do okay in Wisconsin, depending on shade and water and that sort of thing.
Exactly, yeah.
But they're really good selections. The one that I kind of enjoyed as well was the section on plants for goldfinches and other prairie birds. We don't often think about thistle, but the native thistle can be excellent for those birds.
Oh, definitely. And, yeah, I have a few plants that people might find a little controversial, and thistles are one of them. But I think I quote Xerxes, that organization that is trying to promote our invertebrates, like insects and so forth, and native thistles are so great for them, too. And I found not only are they great for goldfinches, they're great for insects, too. But goldfinches particularly have a relationship with thistles. They're one of the few birds that feed only insects, only seeds to their nestlings. So they nest later than most birds, and they kind of wait for thistles to start to blossom and provide seed for their nestlings. They also use that thistle down for their nests. So they have a very special relationship, goldfinches and thistles. And not only that, thistles are great for butterflies. I've seen like 3 butterflies on 1 native thistle. And they're very beautiful, too. If you take a look at the 2 native ones I highlight, one is for wet areas and one is for dry areas. And I have this dry one called a prairie thistle or field thistle, and it really attracts many insects. So I really highly recommend that, as well as this Xerxes organization does. So that's a little controversial. And you might also find in my for the shrubland birds, I mentioned brambles, like raspberries and blackberries. A lot of people really dislike those. They're, if in their yards or in prairies, because they're kind of, they're brambles. They ramble around. They're kind of rather aggressive at times, but they are great for birds. They're just wonderful. So anyway, I really highly recommend those 2 species, even though they're a little unusual.
Yeah. A couple of plants that I have, and we're going to find all over the Wisconsin, I think, are the purple coneflowers and the yellow coneflowers, and they are good for goldfinches and other prairie birds.
Oh, they're wonderful. The purple coneflower is probably the plant the wildflower that really got native flowers on the scene. Purple coneflowers are so beautiful, and the seeds are so great for goldfinches and other finches. And besides that, the flowers are gorgeous. They attract a lot of insects, and I think they're a highlight for any yard. And there's 2 different species, by the way, too. There's one that's just called the purple coneflower and one that's called the pale purple coneflower. Those are, you also mentioned the yellow coneflower. So there's 3 coneflowers there, although the yellow coneflower is a different genus. But anyway, they're all wonderful and easy to grow and wonderful for birds and insects and butterflies.
You're telling me, I'm going to go back to oaks for a minute because I was thinking about goldfinches. And at one point in the book, you tell a fun story about goldfinches relating to your red oak tree. And you bring in Phil Pelletieri.
Right.
Who has been often been a guest on the show. So tell that story about the goldfinches and what they were doing.
Okay, that was very interesting. Yes, they usually devoured seeds at my feeders or on the seed heads in my prairie plants. But one fall, I saw them foraging busily among the leaves of a red oak. And I was wondering, what were they doing? Some of the leaves were completely brown and crisp. Others were still green, but all were loaded with little, small, round bumps, as many as 9 or more per leaf. And I asked Phil Pelletieri to identify them, and he said they were formed by cnipid gall wasps. These are wasps that planted the little eggs on the leaves, and the leaves then formed a little ball around them, a little ball. And so there's at least 10 species of these kinds of gall wasps that can form these little galls on red oak leaves. And the finches were probing the galls and feasting on the protein-packed insects within. And so it was a great eye-opener to me, and it shows how valuable even galls were. Insect-formed galls are on some of our plants.
I thought it was pretty cool. And just a reminder again, Doug Tallamy has often talked about the value of an oak tree and the many species of insects and birds and wildlife in general that thrive under and within and on an oak tree. So it was a pretty cool story to see Phil get a mention in there, too. Kelsey in Madison emailed, is there a way to approach bird-friendly plantings that encourages native Wisconsin birds and also deters pest species like house sparrows? She has so many house sparrows in her neighborhood, and it feels every time she tries to encourage birds in her yard, she just gets more of them instead.
Oh, well, that's too bad. Well, I actually don't think there's any plant that will deter house sparrows, I'm afraid to say, but I sympathize with that. And if you have bird houses, there are traps and different measures that you can do to keep the house sparrows out of your nest boxes. So they must be nesting around, and I guess one thought would be just to try to make sure that they're not in the nest boxes that you might put up. But I'm afraid to say I don't think there's any plant that will deter them.
I have the same issue with my my own feeders, and especially they tend to get covered with house sparrows, and to the detriment of the other birds that a lot of times want to try and get in there to feed, but they get kicked out by the sparrows.
Oh, that's too bad. I'm lucky not to have that problem here.
Well, your book, how's your book doing?
Well, I don't know because it was just out. But a lot of good, I've gotten good reviews of it, and the photographers who I sent the book to or gave the book to, they appreciate it. And I'm thrilled with all the wonderful photos that they offered in the book. I have wonderful photos, as you know, of many births. And I that's what I've highlighted, the relationship, that intriguing relationship between birds and plants and how they both have evolved together and nourish one another in a sense. So, yeah.
I like that you even at the end added in an appendix the top wetland and rain garden plants for birds, which
right.
We have a lot of people here interested in rain gardens. So the herbaceous species, you talk about those. You talk about the shrubs that work well in wetland and rain garden situations. And even the trees.
Right, right. Yeah, and the trees, there's some birds that have special relationships with those trees. As I said, the pine warbler loves the pines, and the red poles love birches, and so forth. So there's, if there are cherries with those tent caterpillars, the cuckoos love those. Last year, there were a lot of caterpillars, especially even the spongy moth caterpillars, and I heard cuckoos every day. This year, there's no spongy caterpillars in my yard or in the neighborhood, so I've only heard cuckoos twice. But it just shows how that the cuckoos had zeroed in and helped us, at least in some, not enough. I don't think we need more cuckoos to really stop those spongy moths, but it was very interesting to note that difference.
Yeah, it is. And your book's interesting for sure, Mariette, and I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today and appreciate the book very much. The title is, it's great to have you with us. Birdscaping for Wisconsin and the Great Lakes Region is the title. The subtitle is The 50 Best Native Plants to Attract Birds to Your Midwest Garden. Mariette Nowak, our guest. Fun having her with us today. Coming up, we're going to take a look at plants and plant diseases with our guest, Brian Huddleston. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.